you know, it kind of gets back to, and I thought it'd be worth mentioning, what are we supposed to be doing as a church? What is our role? Why do we get together on Sunday? You ever like stop and get back and ask yourself, why do we do this? And then why do we, when we get together, you know, I mean, certainly those of us who have been to a lot of different churches, there's all kinds of different things that happen. Why do we study through the scripture? Why is that the central focus? Well, one of the reasons is we look at Ephesians 4, and Paul writes that, you know, the Lord gave some. He gave apostles, those who were sent out with a message, prophets, those who speak forth for the Lord. You know, certainly sometimes it's foretelling, but more frequently it's in Corinthians, exhortation, edification, and comfort for building up the church. Evangelists, people who go out and their gifting is to just spread the gospel. And then pastors and teachers. And the reason why it says is for the perfecting of the saints, for the working of the ministry, and to edify the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith, the knowledge of the Son of God, to become a perfect man, that we won't be children tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine, and that we wouldn't be deceived, but we'd speak the truth in love. That's part of the reason. And so we study the scripture, and part of what we do is to build each other up. Because truthfully, the best outreach, and while there is definitely a part for your Billy Graham crusade or your Harvest crusade or those type of things, most people who even get saved at an event like that get there not because they stumbled out of a bar next door to the amphitheater where Billy Graham was speaking and said, I wonder what they're serving in there, and came in. They're there because there's somebody who knows them, who loves them, who's been talking to them, who's been trying to minister to them, who has been praying for them. And interpersonal, most people who get saved is because of a relationship that they have. And so by us, you know, being put in a position where we understand more, we're in a position to help. And the part of this financial training thing is really for us to equip us to handle our finances, to be in a place where we can be a benefit and help. It's not all about getting rich. You know that. I mean, is there anybody here who's ever come here and me or someone else has asked you for money? Have you ever seen that? That's not what it's about. It's not about that at all. It's all about equipping the saints so that we are properly using the resources. So that's it. But I encourage you, especially if you're struggling, I just like a plan. I appreciate a plan. I appreciate somebody walking through steps. I can copy steps. I'm pretty good like that. So, and it's a great opportunity. If you're interested in it, there's a little table out there. Gordon and Donna will be out there afterwards, and you can speak to them. And this Friday, looking forward to it. So with that said, let's get into our study. We're in Luke. That's where we're going through. We were partway through Luke chapter 21 in the section known as the Olivet Discourse. It's in Luke 21. The parallel passages are Matthew 24 and Mark 13, I forget, right around in there somewhere. It is the second longest teaching of Jesus in the Bible, only behind the Sermon on the Mount. We're really within a couple days of the trial and crucifixion, so time is short, and which means it's important. He had just had all his confrontations with the religious leaders. He had taken the opportunity to point out to his disciples the widow who had almost nothing and just threw in two mites, gave everything to the Lord, and about noticing how she gave. And then somehow in that context, the disciples that were with him pointed out the temple, how awesome it looked, how beautiful it was, and they said, check out the stones and how amazing this place is. And he answered and he said, and we'll just kind of run down through part of it to get a running start from where we left off. In verse 6, he says, as for the things which you behold, the things you're looking at, the days will come in which there shall not be one stone left upon another that won't be thrown down. And considering that some of the stones that made up the temple weighed hundreds of tons, and we're talking 2,000 years ago when there was no gunpowder, dynamite, explosives, the idea that that place would be taken apart to where there would be not a stone left on another was unthinkable. And they asked him, saying, Master, when shall these things be? What will be the sign when these things come to pass? Matthew tells us what they said was, when shall these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? Because they looked at it and said, the only way, that it must be the end of the world. If that's going to happen, if we're going to have that kind of destruction, man, that's got to be the end of everything. And he starts out and he says, take heed that you don't be deceived. He starts out this like, look, don't be fooled by this. Don't let someone come in and lie to you about what's going on. He says, many are going to come saying, I am the Christ, and the time draws near. Don't go out after them. When you'll hear of wars and commotions, don't be terrified. These things must first come to pass, and the end is not by and by. Look, and it's interesting because a lot of times people want to take and say, well, obviously the signs are wars and rumors of wars, and there'll be earthquakes in diverse places, and there'll be famines, and there'll be pestilences, and there'll be, you know, fearful sights and great signs. And so when there's wars, or when there's a famine, or when there's an earthquake, or when there's a pestilence, oh, it's a sign. See, the end is near. And yes, those are signs, but Jesus himself says, look, that stuff has to happen, but that's not the end when you see that. That does not indicate the end. And in other places, it's talked about as, King James uses the word travail. They're like birth pangs. Any of you guys have the pleasure of, well, if you're a lady, going through childbirth? The end of childbirth is a pleasure. Childbirth itself is not typically a pleasure. If you're a guy responsible for a woman going through childbirth and you're in the room, you are at fault. You are wrong, just so you know. You know, I felt so ill-equipped the first time I was in there. I mean, I had a few weeks of Lamaze class, which were some videos that were very hard for me to even watch, to be honest with you. Can't say that I was paying close attention. And then you get in there and you're armed with what? What do they give you? A cup of ice chips to hand her, maybe, in one phrase, breathe, breathe. Oh, yeah, breathe. And it starts, you know, as you're pregnant and you start to grow, and then these things start. You remember what they're called? They're Braxton Hicks, right? I don't know who Braxton is and who Hicks are, but apparently they're the ones who get credit for these little anomalies, which are like the precursor. They're like little clenchies, you know, and they start, and it's like, ooh, what was that? Things just tightened. Oh, it was a Braxton Hicks, you know. Oh, isn't that neat or whatever? And then when you get in and you know, your water breaks, you go into labor, you go into delivery, and things start coming. I remember being in there. Probably the technology has changed since I was in the delivery room, because it has been a little while. But I remember they have that strap-on seismograph they use on your wife, and they've got the little digital, you know, thing that shows when the earthquakes are coming. And then as the contractions pick up, they increase in frequency, they come closer and closer together, and they get stronger and stronger. And the initial reaction to the Braxton Hicks of, ooh, isn't that something, is replaced by, oh no, you know. And the worst part for me, I remember one of them being in there, and that thing was sensitive enough that I could actually see them coming before she really felt that they were coming, you know, and I'd start to see the little needle start to go, or the digital line like that, and then she'd catch my reaction, and oh, it was, and you know how that's what happens. As you get closer and closer to birth and delivery, the signs become closer and more intense. Certainly, I look at what's going on in the world, and things are getting closer and they're getting more intense. But then he says in verse 12, but before all that stuff happens, you know, there'll be earthquakes, diverse places, famines, pestilence, fearful sights, great signs from heaven. And if you're a scholar and you really want to dig into it, an interesting thing to do is to look down in Matthew's account at what he says is going to come the way Matthew lists it out, and compare it with the seals that are broken in the book of Revelation. You will find that they correlate very closely together. But he says, before all of that, he said, they're going to lay their hands on you, and they're going to persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues. Now, how many of you have ever been to a synagogue? How many of you have ever been hauled to a trial in front of a synagogue? They don't really do that anymore. They kind of lost that after 70 AD. So this, in this section here, is really pretty Jewish, and it really was fulfilled in the book of Acts. It happened with Peter and Paul, and they were taken, they were hauled before synagogues, they were hauled before rulers. They were brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And he says, it'll turn to you for a testimony. Settle it therefore in your hearts not to meditate, before what you're going to answer. You don't have to sweat this out and try to lay up, you know, keep in your wallet your testimony in case you have to pull it out sometime on a moment's notice. I mean, obviously, study to show yourself approved, know the scriptures, and know your testimony, but he says, I'm going to give you a mouth and wisdom, and your adversaries won't be able to gainsay or resist. And you'll be betrayed both by parents and brothers and kinsfolk and friends, and some of you they caused to be put to death. In verse 17, that highly evangelistic verse that we all lead with when we're trying to win someone to the Lord, and you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. So become a Christian so you too can be hated by all men. But it's important to realize, Jesus said, look, they hated me. If you're going to follow me, they're going to hate you. If you claim to be a follower of me and you live like I told you to live, you pattern your life, you become a Christian, which is a little Christ, and follow me, and nobody hates you, you might want to check, are you really doing that right? Because if you're actually living like he said to live, you're going to stand out from the world. And even if you're not saying anything, just the way you live can be enough to cause people to see the contrast, feel conviction. But then he says in verse 18, but a hair of your head won't perish. Which, you know, I always say, well, didn't you just tell me people are going to be put to death in verse 16? But by verse 18, a hair of your head won't perish, which means there's a difference between dying and perishing. Two very different things. You know, God so loved the world that he sent his only son that whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. And in your patience, and that word of patience means endurance, possess your souls. And then we covered last week, again, I know this is kind of a long intro. Luke does something that Matthew does not, Mark does not, and he says to them, when you will see Jerusalem compassed about with armies, know that the desolation thereof, of Jerusalem, is near. And if you're in Judea, flee to the mountains. If you're out in the midst of the desert, don't go back in. You know, you see your city attacked, typically you'd want to get in behind the walls. He says, don't do it. Because what happens, and again, Jesus lays this out, 70 AD, this is 30, 40 years before it happens, Titus Vespasian is going to come, surround the city, they're going to starve it out, hold it siege to the point where people are going to be resorting to cannibalism, there's going to be unbelievable death, over a million Jews are going to die, and eventually the temple's going to be burned, even though it was commanded not to happen. All of the gold melts, runs down so that the soldiers pry apart the stones, they destroy the city, wipe it out. So don't go in. And then he said in verse 24, just to jump back a little bit, down a little further, they'll fall by the edge of the sword, they'll be led away captive into all nations. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles shall be fulfilled. Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles. When did the times of the Gentiles start? I guess. When do you think it started? My guess would probably be back when Nebuchadnezzar conquered them and drug them away into captivity. From that point on, they went away into captivity. After 70 years, they come back from captivity, get back into the land again. But they're still not ruling. They're not in charge. They are subjugated. And that pretty much goes on in various forms all the way down through the time when Jesus is there, through Titus Vespasian and the wiping out of Jerusalem again. And of course, Jerusalem, there's nothing there for almost 2,000 years. 1948, Israel is officially declared a nation. Immediately, they're attacked. 67, another war, and they end up reclaiming Jerusalem. But there's still strife. In 1973, it was at the Yom Kippur War, when the war happens again and they're almost wiped out. And even now today, you go there and there's a huge structure on the top of the Temple Mount that is not particularly Jewish. It's called the Dome of the Rock. It's a Muslim temple. And that area is still, in my mind, contested. It's still the times of the Gentiles. What's interesting when you look at this passage is the difference between, well, there's a couple of things interesting, I think. One is the difference between what Matthew says and what Luke says. Luke, a lot of times you see prophecy in the Old Testament or even sometimes in the New Testament, and you see a near-far kind of a thing. The prophets will talk about stuff. They don't, you know, they see they don't see as clearly as you would like. I like to have an exact list of what's going to happen and what day it's going to happen. Sometimes they'll see events and it seems like they'll be talking about a near event, then they'll jump to a real far event. You know, you look at David in when he's prophesying in the Psalms about the crucifixion and everything, and he's kind of talking about himself, and then boom, all of a sudden he's on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's almost like these things get mixed a little in their eyes. Well, in Matthew 24, instead of saying what Luke does, which is in verse 20, when you'll see Jerusalem surrounded, Matthew 24, he says, when you therefore will see the abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let them be in Judea flee and into the mountains. He says, when you'll see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. Now, I don't want to get too, I know it's a Sunday morning, and I don't want to get too much into it, but I think it's important. I mentioned last week when Paul was at Thessalonica, he was only there, started the church, he was only there 3 weeks, and then he got run out of town. So he had a brand new church, no background, nobody knew anything about Christianity. They get saved. He's got 3 weeks to tell them what they need to know before he's driven out of there. And then he ends up writing a couple letters to them to correct some things they had wrong. Not surprising. I mean, can you imagine if you were, those of you who are, when you first knew the Lord, 3 weeks in, congratulations, you're now an elder or a pastor of a church with no background, no nothing, 3 weeks in. Feel qualified? I mean, that's... Well, he corrects a few things, but in every thing, he keeps saying, you remember what I told you when I was there? You remember what I was told you? And every chapter in 1 Thessalonians talks about the return of the Lord, the return of the Lord, the return of the Lord. He really pounded that in. This is happening. It's something you need to know. Jesus is here. It's tied in. His return and also the end of days, it's all tied in with something that happens in Daniel. Daniel chapter 9. And let me just read. If you want to turn there, it'll keep you from being bored, maybe, because you can follow along. If you're familiar with the story of the Jews, they rebel against God. Israel in the north is conquered by the Assyrians. They're carried away, never to come back. Judah and Benjamin in the south, they hang out there for longer. They're not as bad off. But eventually, they get to the point where God allows Nebuchadnezzar to come in and wipe them out and take a bunch of them into captivity. They're there for 70 years. Daniel's one of the guys that's taken early, him and some other young men. They're brought in and trained in Nebuchadnezzar's court because Nebuchadnezzar would try to take the best from every society and incorporate them in to, you know, enhance his knowledge and understanding. And Daniel and three other guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stand out. And the Lord uses them. And then through a series of events where Nebuchadnezzar's having dreams and he doesn't understand what they mean, and the Lord gives Daniel the interpretation, Daniel is raised up to be the point of being a, you know, top advisor under Nebuchadnezzar. Well, he's there, and they're there for 70 years. And we see by Daniel chapter 9, they're still there. He's still advising the king, and he's reading through the scriptures, and he's reading through the book of Jeremiah. And as he's reading through the book of Jeremiah, he comes to the place where Jeremiah says, you're going to go into captivity, and you'll be there 70 years. And he says, we're in captivity, and it's been like 70 years. I ought to start praying. And so he starts praying, and he starts repenting for the nation and everything. And while he's praying, Gabriel the angel shows up. And he says this. It's Daniel chapter 9, in verse 22, in the middle of it. He says, O Daniel, I am now come to give you skill and understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the commandment came forth. You know, as soon as you started praying, I was told, go, and I've come to show you, for you're greatly beloved. Wouldn't it be cool to have an angel show up and say, oh, by the way, you started praying and God heard you and immediately he told me to come because he really loves you a lot. I mean, we have his word saying he loves us a lot, but it'd be kind of nice to have something supernatural looking us in the face saying, oh, by the way, yeah, he's talking about you in heaven and he sent me to you because he really loves you. Well, he really does love you, believe it or not. And he says, understand the matter, consider the vision. He says 70, King James uses the word weeks. It really means heptads or sevens. You know, we talk about decades, and it's like tens. It's a period of 10. The week here, it can be 7 days or it can be 7 years, and it's pretty obvious from the context it's talking about 7 years. He says 70 seven-year periods are determined upon thy people and thy holy city. Who was Daniel's people? What nationality was Daniel? He was from Israel. He was Jewish, right? And what was his holy city? Jerusalem. He was in Babylon. So he says, Daniel, you have to understand, there's 77-year periods left for your people and your holy city. All right? He said, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, make a reconciliation for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up the vision and prophecy, to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the priest shall be seven sevens and three score and two sevens, which when you do the math, it's 69. So there's 77-year periods, 69 of them from the moment that the commandment is given to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah shows up, it's going to be 69 seven-year periods, just so you know that, okay? And he said, and after that, the Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. The people of the prince will come, destroy the city, the sanctuary, the end thereof shall be with a flood until the end of the war of desolation. And then he starts talking about this last seven-year period. He said, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 7-year period, 1 week. And then in the middle of it, in the middle of that week, he'll cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations, he'll make it desolate. And when you go through more of Daniel, and certainly when you look in other places like the book of Revelation, Thessalonians, you start seeing the arrival of this figure. He's called the man of sin, son of perdition. He's called the Antichrist. He says, you know, the Jews, you got 77-year periods. 69 of them are going to happen from when the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah shows up. And when you do the math, we know the day that Artaxerxes Longimanus gave the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem. You do the math all the way out, it ends up, it was 69 seven-year periods from the day the command was given till Jesus comes in on a donkey. Historical, okay? That's why Jesus says, Jerusalem, you should have known. If only you had known this was your day. You should have known because it was told the day. He comes in there because they're going to reject him. He says, you know, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. You won't see me until you say, blessed is him who comes in the name of the Lord. That's that 69-week period. So you got 1 7-year period left. If you look at the book of Revelation, you'll find out it talks about 1 more 7-year period that's yet to happen. You had 69 7-year periods. Then you had this interim where Jesus said, forget it, because you rejected me, it's not to you. Now I'm going to the Gentiles. And then you have this times of the Gentiles still going on until Romans tells us there is what's called the fullness of the Gentiles. Blindness has happened in part to Israel until the last of the Gentiles get saved. And then we start that 7-year period, the last 7-year period. When you look at prophecy, and I understand, look, some of you guys, we talk a lot, especially when you get into the minutia, people talk about, are you pre-trib or mid-trib? There's a tribulation period, that 7-year period. Last half of it's the great tribulation. Is the church here for part of that or all of that or none of that? I think if you want to look at that and be consistent, you need to start with the fact in Daniel that that 7-year period is all about the Jews in Jerusalem. Now, a lot of people got confused for a lot of years. You know, you read back guys like Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all of them, and they looked at what they saw, which is there's nobody in Israel. They're gone. There is no nation of Israel. They haven't been there in their time, 1,400, 1,500 years. All this stuff dealing with Israel doesn't make sense because there isn't one. It must be dealing with the church. So we'll just take the church and we'll do what's called replacement theology, and whenever we see promises to Israel that hasn't happened yet, we'll just dump the church in there. But then in, you know, 1948, all of a sudden, there's an Israel again. In 1967, they've got Jerusalem again. And people started thinking, wait a minute. Maybe there really is promises that are meant for Jews because they're there. They're back in the land. They're speaking Hebrew. You imagine how amazing that is. Just think about that for a second. How many of you took Latin in school? How do you say, can I have a cup of coffee in Latin? How many of you converse in Latin? You know, we throw out the random e pluribus unum or something, but it's a dead language, right? Anybody speak Egyptian? Egyptian? They're not speaking. Anybody speak Philistine? They're dead languages. Those people got conquered. Those people got overrun. They got intermingled with other people. Their language went away. In 1948, they decide Israel ought to be speaking Hebrew again, and they bring it back, and they teach them all Hebrew. And now they're speaking Hebrew in the land again. There's never been a nation that's done what Israel. There's never been a nation that's been separated from their homeland, mingled in with other people for more than a couple generations and still remain uniquely identifiable. The Jews didn't. 2,000 years, even though they were dispersed, they're still distinguishable as a people. They're coming back into the land. So we see all these promises are supposed to happen. We think things are supposed to happen with the temple in the last days and all of that. And then there's a Jewish people there. There's no temple yet. I think it's coming. And he talks about this thing, that the abomination of desolation. Matthew says, well, when you'll see the abomination of desolation. What's the holiest place on earth as far as certainly the Jews were concerned? The holiest place on earth was temple, right? And within the temple, the big spot is the Holy of Holies, right? Where only the high priest could only go once a year. That's the holiest place on earth. The abomination of desolation is when you take the holiest place on earth and you defile it with the worst thing you can do. In the Jews' mind, it had already happened when Jesus came in 167 BC. Seleucid Empire split up. One of the rulers was a guy by the name Antiochus, Antiochus the Great. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes because he had an epiphany, and the epiphany was, I'm God. That was his epiphany. The Jews called him Antiochus Epimanes, which sounded the same, but it really means Antiochus the Insane. He hated the Jews. He wanted to wipe them out. He made it against the law to read the scriptures, like death penalty against the law. Speak in Hebrew, death penalty against the law. At one point, he went into the temple, 167 BC. He brought in a pig. You know how the Jews feel about pork. He had it sacrificed on the temple, sprayed blood all over the inside of the Holy of Holies, tried to make the priests drink the blood. It didn't go over well. In fact, it started what's known as the Maccabean Revolt. And under Judas Maccabeus and his sons, they overthrew Antiochus and kicked him out. And then the Jews celebrate Hanukkah, right? You know, the Hanukkah was when they finally kicked him out and they needed to rededicate the temple. That was the rededication ceremony where they had all new implements because the other ones had all been defiled and they put it back into service. That's Hanukkah. That's why they still celebrate it. But the abomination of desolation was, in their mind, when that pig had been slaughtered, set up an idol to Zeus, slaughter a pig, get the priest to drink, you know, pig blood. That's the worst thing you could do. You take the holiest place on earth and you do the worst thing you do, which put in a pagan god and sacrifice an unclean animal and, you know. But Matthew says, Jesus said, when you shall see it. So apparently it's going to happen again. Thessalonians tells us when that's going to be. And in 2 Thessalonians, there's going to be this, he writes a letter because people were confused thinking the day of the Lord was at hand or they'd already missed the rapture. And he said, look, don't let anyone deceive you. Because that's not going to come until there's a falling away and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that's called God or that's worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God showing himself that he is God. That's going to happen in the middle of the tribulation period. He's going to start. He's going to confirm a covenant. Jews, you can rebuild your temple. They can start sacrificing again. They're going to take receive anybody who promises him peace. Then this guy's going to show up. And in the middle of that, he's going to say, I'm God, demand to be worshipped. And that's the abomination of desolation. So that's still to come, something that's going to happen in the future. And then, verse 25, there will be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars upon the earth, the distress of nations, perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Significant natural events, unlike anything that's ever been seen. You read Revelation 6, Revelation 8 through, you know, 9, 15, and 18, all those things are described. It's going to get so bad that men's hearts, he says, are going to be failing them for fear, looking after those things which are coming on earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. We've got movies about that, right? Armageddon, we have our plan. We'll just take Ben Affleck, who, and Bruce Willis, so Batman and Die Hard guy, and we'll send him up there with a nuke to blow up the thing to save us all from the asteroid that's going to come. Or unless you like Deep Impact, you don't get away from that one. You're Taya Leone and you just stand on the shore and get overwhelmed. Or, I mean, we have these movies and I think we actually do have some kind of plan where we'll try to blow up an asteroid if we see it coming. The problem is we don't always see them coming. Some of the biggest ones that have been near misses, we didn't realize they were coming until they were already by us, you know, so it's kind of a waste to shoot it down if you don't see it coming. But whatever the case, people will be dying. Literally, their hearts will be stopping from fear. And then they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Then they shall see. You know, a lot of people are looking for a sign, and Jesus says, no, you're not going to miss it when I return. And see, I think where the confusion is, I'm a pre-trib person. I think the church is going to go out before the seven-year period where Jesus comes for his church and takes him away, and then at the end of it, he's going to come back with his church. When he comes the first time, we're told it'll be in a twinkling of an eye, right? That it'll just happen like that. When he returns, it says nobody's going to miss it. The sun's going to go out, moon's going to turn to blood, stars are going to fall, and you're going to see him coming in the clouds with great glory. The only light there's going to be is Jesus Christ returning, as from the east, from the west. Every eye on the planet's going to see it. So the only way you can reconcile something happening so fast that nobody sees it and something that nobody's going to miss, I believe, is it coming for his church to take him, and then after the tribulation, which deals with the Jews, coming with the saints. You can disagree. That's okay. We can talk about it if you want. But either way, he says, when these things begin to come to pass, when you see all of this starting, look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near. Don't get freaked out. Look for my return. And he spoke to them a parable. He said, behold the fig tree and all the trees. Now I know the fig tree, okay, the fig tree is a symbol of Israel, but he's not saying just the fig tree, he's saying all the trees. This is just a general parable that we'll all understand, right? Because we're coming to that time. I mentioned before we started this morning, they say it's going to be like 60 or 70 degrees next week. And I think it's only for a few days, so it's all of summer. And then, but you know the signs, right? When we start to get that time when the snow and the ice start to melt and it warms up, and then you see the trees start to bud, right? That's an exciting time for me when the grass, you know, stops being brown and starts to be green again. And he says, well, you know, when you see the buds start, when they shoot forth, you know that summer's coming. You know, I like Chuck Smith's example. He said, when you go out and you go to the store and you see that all of the Christmas decorations are being put out, you know that Thanksgiving isn't far away, right? I mean, that's really what it is. In the same way, when you see these signs start, you know that the final stuff is coming, okay? And then he says something interesting. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. There's been a lot of controversy about that verse. This generation won't pass away until all is fulfilled. Well, was he talking about the people that were sitting there listening to him? Well, no, he couldn't have been, because they all died before this happened. Still hasn't happened yet. I mean, we've had certainly prophetic things happening down through the years, but the sun's still shining last time I checked. The moon hasn't turned to blood, and the stars haven't all fallen, so that hasn't happened. So he couldn't have been talking about those people. Well, maybe he's talking about a generation that sees these things start to happen. Well, if it's the rebudding of the fig tree, and the fig tree represents Israel, then obviously when Israel became a nation in 1948, it all started again. And biblically, if we look in one place, a generation is 40 years, so that's why you had books that said 88 reasons why Jesus will come back in 1988. Those can be had very inexpensively, by the way, if you're looking for those in used books. Because it didn't happen. And then they say, oh, wait a minute, it must have been a generation from 1967 when they retook Jerusalem. So then we'll take 2007, except for we'll back off 7 years for the tribulation period. So 1999, Y2K, Jesus is coming back in Y2K. No, that wasn't it either. Well, maybe in other places they talk about a generation being 75 years. In another place, they talk about a generation being 100 years. Remember, Israel, the Jews went down into Egypt, and then in the fourth generation, they come out, and they were down there for 400 years. So could it be 100 years from 1948 or 100 years from 19? I hope not. I don't want to wait that long. Another way that that word is used, generation, it's called genos, and it's in a couple places it's used to mean race. Is he saying that the Jews will in no way pass away until all of this comes to pass? Maybe. I don't know. I'll let you figure that one out. But regardless, here's the kicker, verse 34. Take heed to yourself, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness in the cares of this life, so that the day comes upon you unaware. With all of this stuff coming, we know it's coming. Whether you think it's, and the thing is, whatever your eschatological, your end times position is, it's very tough to argue with the premise that everybody who wrote in the New Testament, including Jesus when he spoke, spoke imminently. It's coming any moment. Be ready. Be ready. He never expected anyone to say, well, we haven't seen the Antichrist yet, so we don't have to be ready. I've got time. When I see the Antichrist show up, then I'll know. Or when I see a peace treaty, boys, then I'll know it's time to get started. No. He's always talking about don't be asleep. I mean, you've got the parable of the 10 virgins, right? The foolish ones and the wise. Foolish ones didn't have oil for their lamps. They weren't ready. The wise ones had oil. But even when you look at that parable, even the wise ones were all asleep and had to be woken up when he showed up. He always says, don't be asleep. And here he says, look, take heed to yourself. Don't worry about everybody else. Pay attention to yourself. You don't want your hearts to be overcharged with surfeiting. That word, it means hungover. Any of you guys ever experience a hungover? A hangover? Any of you guys hungover this morning? Any of you guys planning on it as soon as I'm done? If you've had a hangover, so I've read. BC, before Christ, right. Yeah, unfortunately, many of us have a BC. Thankfully, many of us have a BC. It's not a CC, current period, you know, current. You have a hangover. Everything bothers you. You feel sick, right? You feel sick. And lights, I don't want to see the light. The light hurt. It burns us, precious. We don't want to see the light. Loud noises. Shh, shh, shh. Just quiet. Leave me alone. I'm getting back in the fetal position. And I'm going to lay in bed because I don't want to go to class. I don't want to go to work. I feel horrible. I feel horrible. I need to get this away. And you notice from that whole idea, it's like me, my. Don't you. Don't show me. Don't tell me. I don't want to hear it. Get out of my face. I need to just. Life, and yeah, obviously being drunk so that you're dulled and you don't know what's going on, or being hungover. But even beyond that, he talks about the cares of this life. You know, you get that parable about the sower going out to sow seed, right? And some of it goes on hard ground, you know, it doesn't go in at all. The seed's the word of God, and it's just, you know, stolen, doesn't have any effect. Some of it, it's on real shallow, and it starts to grow, but as soon as it's sun, boom, it withers and dies. Some of it falls among the weeds, and it grows up. But then the weeds grow up with it, and they choke it out. And when he gives the explanation of that parable, he calls the weeds are the cares of this life. And they're not bad cares, but they're still the cares of this life. And sometimes we can get so caught up in the here and now that we can forget about the there and then and forget that this here and now is not all there is. This is just a staging area for the then and there. And all of our life is to be a preparation for that time and hopefully to bring people with us. So he says, in light of the fact that time is short, take heed to yourself so that you don't get overcharged with surfeiting, drunkenness, cares of this life, so that the day comes upon you unaware. Now, he says, look, for as a snare, it'll come upon all of them that dwell upon the face of the whole earth. A snare. You guys ever, you were Boy Scout, you try to do that thing where you catch something with a snare, or maybe you do the deadfall. You know, the rock on a stick with a little bit of bait in there. When they grab it, it goes down. Or mouse trap. You've probably used a mouse. Not the glue traps. Those take the fun right out of it. I'm talking about the snap ones. Just as a side note, that has nothing to do with anything. My kids have several YouTube channels they like to follow. And one of them is really cool. It's two guys, and they're the high-speed guys. Have you ever seen them where they use, like, these ultra-high-speed cameras to just video different things and then slow it down so you can see it? And I watched one of their videos the other day, and they were running at super slow-mo, one of the guys setting off a mouse trap with his tongue. It's hard to watch. Has nothing to do with anything. But anyway, but as a snare, when that happened, even at the ultra high speed, poof on the tongue, and then you know, the reaction. But when it happens in live speed, bang, it happens fast. That's the idea. Bang, it's going to happen fast. Bang, it's going to happen fast. Imminent. Boom. When things go, they're going to go. going to go. He says, for as a snare, it'll come upon all of them. Sometimes it's important to just notice the tenses of who's being talked to. You take heed to yourself so that you are not unaware, because it's going to come on them and all them that dwell upon the whole face of the earth. That word dwell, it means to be at home at. It means this is your home, as opposed to like an Abraham who never settled down, but he lived in a tent, who was looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. He was never fully at home. Like Jesus, who said, you want to follow me? Well, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, because he wasn't at home in his world. It finally lays down his head. It's on the cross. He said he laid down his head and gave up the ghost when he went. There's them. There's you. You don't want to be one. In Revelation, it talks about multiple times those who dwell upon the face of the earth, those people who make this their home. Watch you, therefore, unlike them, who it's going to come upon unexpectedly, you watch, you pray always, that you may be accounted worthy to escape all of these things. I like that theology. I'm an escapist. You can call me that. If you have another translation, if you're reading the King James or the New King James, and there's a bunch of other ones, yours will say, be accounted worthy. That means you've been, and it's a passive, and so that it doesn't mean like you've done something to earn being worthy. It's like done for you, like God's grace is given to you. If you're reading one of the inferior translations in this case, like if you're NIV positive or whatever, although I think the NIV might be okay. New Living is not so great. ESV, some of them, they talk about, does anybody's verse say something about you'll be strong enough to do this? If yours says it's strong enough, okay, go back and read Revelation about, you know, the stars falling from heaven and a third of the population dying all at once. You're not going to survive that with a shotgun and rice and beans, okay? It's not about your strength. It's about being counted worthy to escape all of these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. I like 1 Thessalonians 5, and I'm going to read that. We'll end with this. And because you can see it very clearly in the tenses. He says, look, 1 Thessalonians 5, of the times and seasons, brothers, you don't have any need that I write unto you. Because you know the day of the Lord comes as a thief in the night. When they shall say peace and safety, sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, like birth pangs. And they shall not escape. But you, brethren, in contrast to them, you're not in darkness that day should overtake you as a thief. You're children of the light, children of the day. We're not of the night, nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others. Let us watch and be sober. Because those that sleep, sleep in the night. And those that are drunk, get drunk in the night. But let us, and again, they sleep, they are drunk. Us, we're not. We're of the day. Let us be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. Why? Because God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or whether we sleep, whether alive or dead, we should live together with him. Wherefore, comfort yourselves together and build one another up, even as also you do. I was deathly afraid. As a child, I had religious parents, and I had been to enough, you know, Pentecostal prayer meetings and church services that I'd had the living daylight scared out of me, you know. And I knew the Lord was returning, and I knew I wasn't right with him. I knew that. I knew enough to know that I wasn't right with him. But I also figured I had time. And I told the story, I've told it multiple times, and I know my sister's already laughing because she knows, you know, she knows. I knew, you know, we heard about the last trumpet. You knew it was coming. And I lived in Wynn, right next to the railroad tracks. And every day, twice a day, the train would go by our house. And when it got near the crossings at the end of our road, they would do the horn. And I have vivid memory. And I forget a lot of things. My memory's horrible. You know, when I'm old, be kind to me. But I remember being woken up because the place is shaking and I'm hearing and thinking, that's it, it's the rapture. I've missed it, it's too late. And then it's like, well, I gotta know, is this really it or not? So I run to find somebody to see whether they're all gone and I'm left behind. and there's Sandra. That's no assurance. I gotta find my parents. I'm not afraid now of the idea of the return of the Lord. As life goes on and things get harder, I'm looking forward. If you're one of those people who's praying, oh, don't let it be today because I'm not ready. I got more I want to do. No one understand there are some of us here praying against you. Let it be today. Because if you're right with him, the return of the Lord is not fear. It is peace. It's no more pain. It's no more tears. It's no more doubt. It's no more asking why. It's never having to say goodbye. It's no more weeping. If you're not ready for him to return, it stinks living that way. I would encourage you, don't leave that way. Come see me. I'd be glad to pray with you and tell you all about him. If you are a follower of his, let's not be drunk. Let's not be dulled. Let's not be asleep. Let's not be acting like we're hungover and just ignoring the times. Time is short.